And he had set his eyes on a certain maiden, Miriam or Mariam as she's called, of that house. And one day he heard a bat kol say, every slave that rebels now will succeed. So he rose and killed all the members of his master's household, all the chashmonayim, and he spared that maiden. It's fairly close to the historical story. When he saw that he wanted to marry her, when she saw that he wanted to marry her, she went up to the roof and cried out, whoever comes and says, I am from the Habet Chashmonayim, is a slave, since I alone am left of it, and I am throwing myself down from the roof. She jumps off the roof, she kills herself, she commits suicide, and that leaves Herod without Mariam. He preserves her body and honey for 7 years. Some say he had intercourse with her, some say he didn't have intercourse with her. According to those who said he did have intercourse with her, his reason for embalming her was to gratify his desire. According to those who say he did not have intercourse with her, his reason was that people might say that he had married a king's daughter. So Herod is not really of the royal stock. Herod, by the way, is a half-Jew. He, by the way, is assumed to be done some type of conversion to Judaism. He was an Edomite. And he's now, he is the king over Israel, Judea, excuse me. And his problem is he's not really a born Jew, and he's surely not from the Davidic house. So he says, who are they who say, he said, who teach that the only kinds of kings from the midst of thy brethren shall thou set up a king over thee? That the king has got to be Jewish. Who said this? Stressing the word brethren. The rabbis. He therefore rose and killed all the rabbis. So what does Herod do? Kills all the rabbis. Well, if you don't like the law, what do? You eliminate the people of the law. He only kept one rabbi alive, Rav Bava ben Buta. They may take counsel of him. He has a court rabbi. And he put on his head a garland of porcupine bristles, hedgehog bristles, and put out his eyes, made him blind. And when they came before him, he said, see, sir, what this wicked slave Herod does. He wanted to see how Bava ben Buta really was supportive of him or not. Bava ben Buta is blind. He doesn't know who's standing in front of him. And he says, look what this wicked Herod does. This is Herod speaking. Rav Bava ben Buta says, what do you want me to do to him? So Herod says, I want you to curse him. And Bava ben Buta gives back the responds with the verse, even in thy thoughts you shall not curse a king. Herod says to him, but this is no king. He's not a real king. You know, he's not a legal king, not a legitimate king. And Bava ben Buta says, even though he's only a rich man, and he quotes him another pasuk. And even if he's no more than a prince, I still can't curse him. And then Herod says, well, that only acts, that's only applies to someone who acts as one of your people. But this man does not act as one of your people. So Herod is very, like, he's playing along. He's not telling him who he is. He's trying to get Bava ben Buta to say something against himself. But you see, he recognizes what he's done. And Bava ben Buta says, well, I'm afraid of him. But Herod says, well, there's no one who's going to tell him. We're alone, just you and me. And he quotes the verse, for a bird of the heaven shall carry the voice, and that which has wings shall tell the matter. Then Herod says, oh, wow, you're really faithful, or you can't get, if not faithful, at least you're not going to say anything against me. I'm Herod. Had I known that rabbis are so circumspect, I should not have killed them. Okay, so tell me, what amends can I make? Okay, I'm sorry I killed the rabbis. I did this in a fit of rage because I really thought the rabbis were worse than they are. What can I do better? And the story goes on and on and on. And Bava ben Buta says, if you really want to make amends for killing all the rabbis, only one thing you can do, and that is to rebuild the Beit Mikdash. As you have extinguished the light of the world, for the rabbis are so called, as it is written, for the commandments light, commandments of the Torah are, go now and attend to the light of the world, which is the temple. Okay? Or he quotes another verse, and so forth and so on. Herod says, what shall I do? I'm afraid of the government of Rome. Just skipping now a couple lines right after superscript 9. And Bava ben Buta says, you know, send them an envoy to Rome. There was no email. You have to send someone by horseback, foot, and it'll take him a year to get there. He'll stay in Rome for a year. Take him a year to get back. In the meantime, knock the temple down and rebuild it. And sure enough, in 3 years he builds the temple. The envoy he sends to Rome finally gets a chance to come back. And he comes back with the following message. The message is, if you haven't pulled it down, don't pull it down. But if you pulled it down, do not rebuild it. Now, if you have pulled it down and already rebuilt it, you're one of those bad servants to do first and ask permission afterwards. And even though you strut with a sword, you think you're great, we know your genealogy, we know you're son of slaves, and you're not a Rekha nor a son of Rekha, you're not royalty, but you are a free man who made yourself into the king. Okay, that's the end of the story. What does the story really tell us about Herod? This is the great Herod who put up the temple. Herod pulls up the temple. A, it's expiation for all for killing all the rabbis. B, Herod's a pretty miserable guy, which you probably knew. And C, when you go to the Kotel and you look at Herod's stones, you got to put this all into some type of historical perspective. So, I think what I'm really trying to head to here is on a day of Tisha B'Av, in a time that we historically think of trauma taking place to Jewish people, took place to Jewish people, it's taking place to Jewish people. This is not the first time that we have suffered trauma in the history of Jews living in Israel. And as negative as we talk about evicting Jews out of Gush Katif, it does not impact, or should not impact, in the long run, on the fact, the support that we have for the sovereignty of Israel. By the way, it is a little different. In fact, the religious Zionism has always tried to work within the system. We from the beginning of the Zionist movement, the religious Zionist movement has tried to ensure the Jewish character of Medina Yisrael within the system. And this is something we feel very directly works against us. But even then, things have not always been as smooth. Medina Yisrael gives power to the rabbinical courts and have power over all matters of personal status and marriage and divorce and conversion, but the courts try to limit that. And at the same time, we still have managed to work within a system of the state of Israel itself. I think what the message of the Gemara is, and it's maybe not a happy message from the story of Rav Shimon Shetach and Yanai Melech, is that sometimes it may be imprudent or not the best to impose halachic authority, even though we have the halachic right to do so. Or at the very least, that we have to be very sensitive in terms of trying to exercise our religious authority. And I think that's maybe what we recognize when we work with Torah values, when they come into conflict with a government that is both supportive of developing a country, at the same time may not be fully supportive of all the religious values that we perhaps hold important to ourselves. There are risks that are involved in imposing Torah law on a civil authority that does not accept a Torah authority. And therefore, sometimes restraint, may be better than other times. Now, having said all that, I want to talk about, just for a few moments, and kind of put on a more positive note, living with a state that does not keep Torah values. That's maybe some of what we try to think about on Tisha B'Av itself, how we could build a country that lives on Torah values. But the fact that the Medina falls short of halachic ideal, how do we look at this from a halachic perspective? Do we simply walk away from it? Do we become the Shimon Shetachs? Do we become the Dayanim in the story? Or do we look at it from a halachic construct as well? I just want to spend a few minutes before we close out. There's a rule in halacha called chatzi shir. Chatzi shir means that I'm supposed to eat on Pesach, you're supposed to eat a kazayit of matzah. So what happens if you didn't eat a kazayit of matzah? I only ate half a kazayit of matzah. Okay, so I didn't do the mitzvah. But does that mean I did nothing? So from a halachic construct, I may not have done the mitzvah. But from a philosophical point of view, I clearly did something for eating the matzah. So chatzi shir is not nothing, it is something. Let me give you an opposite example. For example, one cannot eat on a fast day, Yom Kippur, Tisha B'Av. But in order to eat, you have to eat, let's say, a kazayis. So what does that mean? I can walk around and eat less than a kazayis, and I'm okay? And the answer is that's what we do say to people sometimes who need to eat small amounts, right? To drink a little bit of water with a pill or small amounts that they need to eat during a Tisha B'Av or during a Yom Kippur. But we don't say that to everybody. Well, why not? Isn't the shear a kezayit? And the answer is, yeah, but less than the shear, it's still something. It may not be halachic, but it's pseudo-halachic. It's almost halachic. And there's a large discussion among the Achronim whether how one views this from a halachic perspective. And if you look in the Encyclopedia Talmudit, there's a whole long list of authorities in the 16th Kraft, the 16th volume, that go back and forth on this. Now, that's a halachic perspective. So if you look at Eretz Yisrael, or Medinat Yisrael today, one can try to present it in the same way. And I think it's important to present it in a week like this, where we are so depressed. Okay? Medinat Yisrael partially fulfills the mission of a Jewish government. In the same way that Yana HaMelech did, in the same way that Herod did. The Rambam in Hilchot Malachim, it's one of the last sources that you have, it's on page 5, once again, it's not in English. Source number 10. The Rambam in Hilchot Malachim, chapter 4, writes that why do we appoint a king? So, that we appoint a king to establish justice and to wage war. Okay? And the Rambam writes, The reason you put up a king is to do justice and to fight war. It's about Samuel talking about how they're going to set up a king who will judge them, who will lead them and fight their wars. It's very clear that Tzahal does that. They defend the lives of 4 million Jews in the land of Israel. A function of the king is to punish criminals in an extra legal manner. And the Rambam also includes that in Hilchot Melachim, that the king is able to bring justice and to break and lishbar zwar harashayim, to break the arms of the wicked. There is a basic system of law in the land of Israel. It does have a criminal justice system. Sometimes, by the way, once again, it's chatzi shir. The judicial system sometimes, many times, ignores Jewish law in favor of non-Jewish legal systems. Okay, especially in areas of monetary law. But it's still a system that works. The Talmud also talks about another role of the king, which is to ensure that the economy is healthy. The Talmud in Brachot, I did not give you this, but King David, who discussed the well-being of the economy with leaders of the community. The Gemara, by the way, holds Saul, King Saul, responsible for the economic failure of a section of Israel. It's a Gemara Masechet Baba Batra, Baba Kama. And in our time, let's be honest, The Medinat Yisrael has really allowed Israel to emerge as one of the leading markets in the world. This allows Israel to absorb more Jews. It allows its people to move there. The Rambam writes the king is supposed to fill the world with justice. Yes, well, it does have a system of justice. Not only justice about demonstrations, but justice about universal health coverage and Bituach Lumi and national insurance. Medina Yisrael absorbs Jews from distressed lands. The Rambam writes, not here but in Sefer HaMitzvot, that another role of the king is to unify the Jewish people. Now, you can argue that this week may not be the best week to talk about unification of the Jewish people. But the fact that we talk about it is because we are unified. The fact that that there are disagreements, and it's not just a source of friction. At the same time, without the State of Israel, there would be nothing that would bind all Jews together, regardless of the level of observance and affiliation. The State of Israel allows 4 million Jews, plus 4 million plus Jews, to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. without the Medina, this would clearly be impossible. One goes back and studies how many Jews lived there before 1948, before the Zionist movement took over. I have a map, and I've showed it to some people. It's a map, it's a JNF map that was published in 1920 of all the land that JNF owned in 1920. And every time we get depressed about, you know, what happened there, so you pull out the map and you see how little we actually owned in 1920. Did bits and dots and little pieces that were not connected. And yet, the Medinas allowed that to happen. The Rambam writes, I just read it before, I didn't translate, I'll translate now. The king's missions and thoughts should be directed to promote the true religion. Okay. One can argue that this is not really carried out. The present government clearly may have certain elements that are clearly not halachic. However, and there is a very important however, that the government does support schools and batei knesiot, shuls, mikvaot, and batei dinim, and is supportive of a lot of Jewish things in terms of what's going on. So, to kind of bring it together, what I think it's important for us to kind of put both parts of the story together. This is no doubt a very difficult week. And the fact that this is falling out around Tisha B'Av is probably not by accident. It's so a plan that perhaps the Almighty put into place that we should all have greater introspection with those who live and those in Israel and those who live here and those who live around the world about what the events really mean and portend. And if you will remember, initially the eviction was supposed to take place, I think, a week or two earlier during the 3 weeks. And the government said, well, we can't do it in 3 weeks. That's like alapanim. So they pushed it off till after Tisha B'Av, not realizing that the real focus are the few days before Wednesday, when they must be out, when it really galvanizes our attention and world attention. So the most important thing here is, as much and as difficult as this is, and I'm not belittling this, and I really want to make that very clear, I'm not belittling this, because I think it's so important that we keep this in the forefront. At the same time, recognize it's not the first time that there's been a king, a ruler that's been antagonistic to Jewish values. And at the same time, to recognize that the day of Tisha B'Av itself gives us a moment to recognize that we are missing the Beit Mikdash, we're missing a temple, we have a land of Israel, and we have something that is that can be positive. It's, of course, for us to allow it to make it and become more positive. So keeping this all together, I think, helps us focus on the day of Tisha B'Av, where we really need to keep in mind the difficulties, the pathos, the trauma of this week, together at the same time, in a larger perspective, with what happens in Medina Israel. Thank you.